Monster Man, special episode, Vecna. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Paul. If you'd like to be like Paul and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do, you'll also get access to the benefits of lower levels, like all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, which is all about the religion and mythology of the world and what we can take from it for our fantasy role-playing games. So Paul, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. So Paul has asked me to talk about Vecna. And Vecna is probably undergoing one of the periods of history in which he is best known right now. Probably more people have heard of Vecna at this time than at any other. He's maybe D&D's most recognizable villain. Maybe second to Strahd, but probably not. He is, of course, referenced in the most recent series of Stranger Things. So where the kids in Stranger Things used D&D terms to describe monsters in previous seasons, here where they are describing more of like a villain character, they decided to call it Vecna, which makes sense. And I believe that the baddies that we saw in the trailer for the new Dungeons & Dragons movie are probably some kind of cultists of Vecna. I haven't looked into it too much, but the sort of color scheme and the kind of lichiness made me think that. So who is Vecna and what is his deal? Vecna is one of the oldest named characters in D&D, or is he? His name is an anagram of Vance, like Jack Vance, the fantasy writer whose work was such an important inspiration for things like, for instance, the D&D magic system, and who certainly had that habit of naming things after people. So I think contextually that is quite important. So, you know, you're always running into like so-and-so's marvelous such-and-such in Jack Vance's Dying Earth books. Vecna is first referred to in Eldritch Wizardry, the 1976 supplement for original D&D. And this supplement introduced many of the best-known artifacts and monsters in D&D, things that would come to be in every edition of the game from then on. So things like the Rod of Seven Parts or the Axe of the Dwarvish Lords, the Mace of St. Cuthbert, etc., etc. But probably the best known of the magic items introduced in Eldritch Wizardry are the Eye of Vecna and the Hand of Vecna. And in the descriptions of those artifacts, Vecna is not described in any great detail. He is just a powerful, quote, ancient lich, close quotes. The focus is on the artifacts themselves and on the horrible way that they are used. So if you want to use the Hand of Vecna, you have to cut off your own hand and graft the mummified Hand of Vecna onto the stump. And then you will gain some of Vecna's evil powers. Or if you want to use the Eye of Vecna, you have to gouge your own eye out and insert the Eye of Vecna into the socket, which is a pretty horrifying image. And of course, you will gain some of Vecna's evil powers, and also I believe you turn evil, which, you know, someone who uses these artifacts can literally rival the gods, right? So powers, so I mean, it actually says changes that have been made with the Vecna body parts, I think it may be only the hand, cannot even be undone by the gods, which is pretty extreme. So these artifacts are very memorable, first because they're super powerful, but second because they have this gruesome aesthetic. You know, it's more than just like picking up a sword or something or a staff. And they also have some spooky, sinister language about them in an era when D&D item descriptions were often pretty terse. But not much information about actual Vecna appears in their entries. If we go further into the history of D&D and we look at the AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide from 1970, whatever it is, 79, something like that, this gives us much the same information on the hand and eye, and sort of gives us the famous phrasing that is usually repeated, when people talk about Vecna, seldom is the name of Vecna spoken except in hushed voice, and never within hearing of strangers. Which is, again, pretty much a direct adaptation of what's in Eldritch Wizardry, which makes sense because it only came out a few years previously, but also, again, leaves a lot of unanswered questions. Strangers, so who is it that talks about Vecna? We don't know, and there's no standard setting for this game. There's no information about Vecna other than that he was a powerful lich. In fact, it would be over another decade before Vecna as a character appeared in an AD&D book, and that was in 1990's Vecna Lives. And Vecna is doing that thing that happens to, like, the Doctor in Doctor Who, where his popularity with the fan base and his importance to the product means that he is increasing in power in the universe. So Vecna was once an ancient lich who was destroyed but left some artifacts behind, but now he is a demigod. After being defeated, he gets sent off to the Ravenloft setting. Is this a thing that people really care about? Like that time that Lord Soth went to Ravenloft? Like, I can't imagine running a... Where's Soth from? Dragonlance? Running a Dragonlance game and then being like, oh, well, can't use Soth anymore. He's in Ravenloft now. And I don't know that I would bring Vecna into the gothic horror setting of Ravenloft, where what makes him unique is kind of diminished, right? He's just sort of, we've already got the mummy and Dracula. You know, I don't know that we need this guy who is so, like, thematically close to both of those villains already. Anyway, whatever. That's not important, because he didn't stick around. There's a couple other adventures that he appears in. He turns up in third edition as a lesser deity, and ever since then, he's been turning up among the evil deities. He's got alliances and rivalries with other kind of quote-unquote major characters. So Ioun is his enemy. That's another Jack Vance reference. The Ioun stones are from Jack Vance's Dying Earth books. You know, but he fights Yuz, and Acererak used to be one of his lieutenants, and so on. That stuff is all fine, but to me it feels secondary. It is a comment on the existing popularity of Vecna. A lot of the time when I say I have a possibly controversial view on something, it turns out my view is actually pretty much the mainstream, and I'm just imagining people to disagree with me, which is a pretty common thing for me to do. It's like an anxiety thing. Because here's what I think about Vecna. I think that Vecna, qua Vecna, Vecna in his red robes with his, like, pallid face and whatever, is just another supervillain. He's just Voldemort or whatever. He's fine, there's nothing wrong with him, but there's also not anything super distinctive about him either, except the eye and the hand. Because there are tons of people whose favorite magical artifacts in D&D are the Eye of Vecna and the Hand of Vecna. These two paragraphs from Eldritch Wizardry, more or less conceptually anyway, the same as they were in 1976, definitely among the most recognizable D&D artifacts. I mean, there's people who like Black Razor, and there's people who like the apparatus of Qualish, you know, whatever. There are a lot of people for whom their favorite artifacts are the Eye of Vecna and the Hand of Vecna, but despite its cool name, I don't think that Die Vecna Die as a scenario is really mentioned in the same breath as Against the Giants or whatever. You know what I mean? Vecna, when he appears, has always been a little underwhelming compared to when he does not. Because I think that what Vecna contributes to the game is guidance on how to seed a villain, or in actuality, any piece of setting information. Now, technically, I understand that Vecna was not seeded because it was not expected that he would actually turn up. Whether, in fact, he was a villain in Brian Bloom or whoever wrote him's D&D game, I do not know. Or whether it was only ever the Eye and the Hand. But the Eye and the Hand were not being put into the game in the, like, anticipation of setting up the later reveal of Vecna. Vecna was put into the game later on by people who were big fans of the Eye and the Hand. So there are three things that make this a good way of conveying information about a game, or setting up a character in advance, or whatever you want to do with it. First, it is incorporated into the kinds of things that the players care about. So we're not just reading some history lesson about how Vecna was a human wizard, and then he became a necromancer, and then he became a lich, and he had an evil empire, and he had a bunch of minions like Cass and Acererak and whoever. Is it Cass? Whatever. The vampire. Instead, we are having that information communicated to us through something that might come up in the game that could be used at the table, right? A magic item. But it could be a spell, a monster, a dungeon, whatever. The information is interactable, it's playable, and that makes it more memorable because we're not just reading about it, we are engaging with it. Second, the aesthetics are very clear and consistent. I'm sure I've said this before, but a long time ago, I think this was on the old comic book blog, Dave's Longbox. There were a lot of these kind of comic book blogs in the early 2000s, and I was procrastinating a lot at the time, so I remember them very clearly. Maybe the early to mid, kind of 2003 to 2010, I think was sort of their heyday. Anyway, I'm sure I've quoted this before, but I think on that blog, the author talks about the idea that being a supervillain is really about branding. I remember the line, he's talking about the Fantastic Four villain, Annihilus. He says, Annihilus has a monstrous, frightening appearance. And he reinforces this brand identity by, one, annihilating things, and two, raving like a maniac. And so I feel like Vecna's brand identity, if we want to use that phrase, is reinforced by how gruesome and morbid the artifacts associated with Vecna are. You have to chop off your own hand and attach a severed mummy hand to it. That's gruesome and macabre. And even though you could have the exact same mechanical effects just from having the crown of Vecna or the scepter of Vecna, it is not at all the same as poking out your own eye and sticking in a mummy's eye. It tells you something about the kind of people who would like to get their hands on these artifacts, i.e. people who make bad choices. Third, the description is actually kept to a minimum. Vecna in the magic items is presented with no more than a few lines intended to convey an atmosphere of superstitious dread. A lot of description can be counterproductive. The elaboration of Vecna's backstory doesn't really add a lot that you wouldn't expect. It's just a very detailed way of filling in what everybody already imagined, which was that he was an undead tyrant. You know, studied magic, dread empire, campaign of conquest and massacre, betrayed by his own minions. It's all pretty much what you would have come up with in the first place, and so I don't think it's as good as these little descriptions, which convey the atmosphere of Vecna efficiently and elegantly. And even though I think that Vecna, as revealed, is kind of just a supervillain, same supervillain as everybody else, I have to admit that there is a cachet to it being Vecna that exists. When you reveal that the evil that these cultists are trying to bring back into the world is Vecna, your players will go, wait, with the hand? Oh no. Okay, so let's have a think about applying this in a game. It seems to me that you want to have your villain setup be one among many, right? Every offhand reference in a published D&D book eventually gets footnoted into full-blown existence, and I think it is a mistake to take all of those things and use them in your game, right? So you can have a lantern of Igwilf, and you don't have to have Igwilf. And you can have an apparatus of Qualish, but you don't have to have Qualish. I don't even know who Qualish is. You should normalize the idea that objects have biographies and that unique items are kind of known, you know, by the people associated with them. But that doesn't mean that every one of those has to get expanded. I have kind of a weird relationship with Street Fighter. I'm sure I've mentioned Street Fighter a bunch of times. I am not good at Street Fighter, but its mythology is fascinating to me. I volunteer at a museum of computing history, and it has a Street Fighter 2 arcade cabinet, and I like to play Street Fighter 2 from time to time, even though I'm bad at it. But the mythology of Street Fighter, I've written about this before, the mythology of Street Fighter was very compelling to me when I was younger, partly because it was so, half explained. So when I watched the TV show, or web series, I guess, Street Fighter Assassin's Fist, it goes into such a great detail about explaining every part of the sort of hero's origin, right? It's kind of an origin story for Ryu and Ken that focuses on the conflict between Goki and Goken, which if you don't play Street Fighter, none of that means anything to you, but it is also not important. But it's oh, here's the scene where Ryu gets his gloves. Here's the scene where Ryu learns his motto. Here's the scene where someone composes Ryu's stage theme. Every single bit did not require this kind of explanation. you're much better off with something that just gives you an evocative sense of mystery than having to footnote everything, unless you're the editor of Dragon Magazine and you have by gum got so many pages to fill each month, in which case, I hope you fellas like articles about the history of the Forgotten Realms. But what you should do is throw out as many cryptical references as you can, because you can always explain them later if you want to. Right? If you're dropping clues from the Chronicles of St. Serbido, and then later on the players find the Tomb of St. Serbido, it'll be cooler to them because it feels like a revelation. It feels consistent with what they already know, and it's more fun to explore the Tomb of St. Serbido than it is to explore the Tomb of St. Berbido, who you've never heard of. I think you can work this into a number of different things, right? So, like, let's say we're trying to set up Dark Lord Xurgathrex, and we've already maybe, like, mentioned him from time to time. You know, we might even work it into the history of a dungeon. So, you know, this tower was devastated by the Midnight Legions of Lord Xurgathrex, and since then, dark things have come here and abode in it. Or you could work it into the backstory of an item that isn't from the Xurgathrex family of magical items. So for instance, everybody's looking for the Sword of Light to defeat, you know, the vampire. But it's like, oh, well, you know, originally the Sword of Light was forged to defeat the Shadow Dragon that Xurgathrex rode into battle. Traditionally, if you're doing an ancient evil kind of thing, a la Vecna, you want to have an agency of some kind that wants to bring the ancient evil back into the world. The classic choice is a Cult of Idiots. I do think that it'd be a good thing to explore it in more detail, because if you are thinking about, like, fighting the Conspiramid, to take an idea from, I know it from the Vampiramid in Night's Black Agents, but the Conspiramid actually comes from somewhere else, I think. It's from the Esoterists, maybe? I don't know. But the idea of the pyramid structure, you're going to be spending most of your time dealing with the lower levels of the pyramid. So you kind of want to know more about those guys than you do about Dark Lord Xurgathrex. What kind of problems must you have in order to think that bringing back a devastating tide of supernatural evil is a good solution to them? Or maybe do you think you're going to be made one of Xurgathrex's undead lieutenants? Are you so filled with hatred and vengefulness that you'll doom the world just to get back at the people that you feel have wronged you? Or are you maybe just fooled, right? Do you think you're trying to make the world a better place and it's your boss who, you know, donned the bone corslet of Xurgathrex and got turned evil, who is kind of fooling you? Fighting Vecna himself can sometimes seem like one of those things that, like, weakens his majesty a little. The problem with using a great villain more than once is that you run the risk of kind of, you know, Cobra Commander syndrome, where a villain's sense of menace gets reduced by the fact that they keep shimping fights to the heroes. I felt a little way about this. I was watching somebody play, I don't play a lot of video games, but I often have, like, while I'm writing, I often have some noise in my second monitor. Just kind of helps me think. I don't know why I'm like that. And I was half, you know, with one eye watching somebody play a Warhammer 40,000 computer game. And the villain in it is Mortarion. Mortarion is the Primarch of the Death Guard. So he's a baddie. And they were doing this cutscene in which Mortarion is, like, chewing out one of his minions who got defeated by the player characters. And it's fully, like, I mean, he doesn't actually say this, but it's very much like, imbecile, you have failed me for the last time kind of stuff. And I was just like, man, this is dumb. Like, they're treating Mortarion like he's just some kind of corny comic book supervillain. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, that is exactly what he is. What am I talking about? He's not a tragic figure. He's a toy for kids. But this does kind of weaken his image a little bit, you know? So you probably want to do the conventional monster summoning thing where you're preventing him from appearing at all. You know, one bony hand comes out of the casket and then you smash the blue jewel and the day is saved. Because you don't want to just be like, oh, well, then Dark Lord Xurgathrex turned up and we beat him in a stand-up fight, because it's less compelling. On the other hand, maybe just whooping a bunch of his minions in the ruined temple of Xurgathrex is, you know, a bit of an anti-climax. Nothing worse than kicking Dr. Doom's butt only to discover it was actually a Doombot. But I feel like there's a charm to most of your antagonists being idiots playing with matches. Finally, I'm mentioning this so that it doesn't come up in the comments. I can't believe that I didn't say that the Eye and the Hand of Vecna are examples of what is often called environmental storytelling. So environmental storytelling in say, a video game, a classic example would be in something like the Fallout games. As you are going around the world, you're constantly finding these little scenes, these little vignettes, often in the form of, like, skeletons in humorous positions, that kind of tell you a little bit about what was going on in the place that you are now exploring. And it's a pretty common feature of dungeon design, too, since a lot of dungeons are some kind of ruin. A lot of dungeons are landscapes that communicate, but don't communicate directly. A setting or location detail that lacks a specifically narrative element that's environmental storytelling, right? It's contributing to the overall quote-unquote narrative, but it is not itself telling a story. This is something that RPGs are very good at, and players love to construct the stories themselves. They love to take those pieces and assemble them. Again, that's that interactivity that I talked about that makes the eye and the hand of Vecna so good compared to just a history lesson about Vecna. The eye and the hand aren't even just like methods of imparting information about Vecna, which would be their least interesting purpose. What they are is reinforcing through play certain themes. And I think it's good to resist the urge to turn the players into the audience. The more of Vecna's story, if Vecna's story is the story of some lich in the past and his tragic fall, if Lord Soth's story is the story about, like, oh, he murdered his wife and yada yada yada, that is outside the context of the players. The story of Vecna is the story of how one power-hungry fool got his hands on the Eye of Vecna. Or I was going to say he got his hands on the hand of Vecna, but of course, he didn't have hands for the entirety of the story. For a while, it was just hand. Those are participatory, because even if you're not the power-hungry fool with the Eye of Vecna, you're the poor sap who's got to stop him, and I think that that's important. So okay, that is what I think about Vecna, or more properly, the Eye and Hand of Vecna. Hi there, this is James from the future, dropping in to talk about something I didn't discuss during the episode, which is, of course, the famous tale of the Head of Vecna. Now, in the unlikely event that you haven't heard of this, just, you can Google it. It's an old gamer urban legend, folktale. It was told to me as a story that had happened to a friend of a friend, rather than, like, the, you know, circulating message board thing. And, you know, it's funny and all. But I don't know that it's very relevant to this episode, except that the fact that it exists and that it relies on you to know what the Eye and the Hand of Vecna are, and it assumes that, like, anyone will know that, you know, I think demonstrates how widespread those things were. In fact, because I didn't play D&D as a kid, the story of the Head of Vecna is where I heard of the Eye and Hand of Vecna. So there we go. I didn't feel like there was a lot of connection to the episode, but I also knew that if I didn't mention it, I would get comments. So I do know about the Head of Vecna. I return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. Paul, thank you once again for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, as before, if you'd like to be like Paul and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we will be returning to Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, 2nd edition. So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.